All right, I'm going to tape this. We'll see how far we can get after two long days of loading books from the library.
Okay, we're going to read On Sense and Reference by Frege.
Sinn und Bedeutung.
Frege is a mathematician who's studying the foundations of arithmetic.
Is he actually a mathematician? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
He's interested in number theory. A lot of important work was going on during Frege's time. I believe he's a rough contemporary of Peano and Hilbert.
Basically, last half of the 19th century.
Right. And so they were doing work in infinities and irrationals, and Frege's basic question was, well, this is all great, but how do we understand, do we really have a firm grasp of what a number is? And so his project begins what is called the foundations of math, or philosophy of mathematics. And so his project is to understand what a number is. Now, Kant is something of a Kantian.
You mean Frege?
Who did I say?
Kant.
I thought I said Frege is something of a Kantian.
You said Kant is something of a Kantian.
Well, Kant, that's certainly true. Kant is a Kantian. But Frege is something of a Kantian. He believes that geometry, for example, Frege, that Kant got geometry right, that it is analytic and it is a synthetic a priori.
But did he take the radical Kantian interpretation of the other world that's not spatial or geometric, but it's a form of our intuition only? Though that's all we can say about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Not sure. But he thought arithmetic was purely analytic. And so this is a view in the philosophy of math called logicism, that ultimately math, or arithmetic in Frege's case, remember he puts geometry in a different category, arithmetic is reducible to logic. And so he begins his work, but realizes that the logic of his day, which is basically classical logic with some developments, you know, the 19th century did produce some developments in logic before Frege.
Well, the Boolean system, was that was already in place,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But he had the Boolean supplement to Aristotle.
Right. Okay. And he had the Stoic supplement. But it wasn't rich enough. And so Frege goes and invents a new system of logic, which is, if one goes to college and takes anything beyond a critical thinking class, they will get first-order predicate logic, or sometimes called the logic of quantifiers. And so Frege writes a book called Concept Writing, Begriffsschrift, and basically lays out modern first-order predicate logic. Now, he doesn't... The way in which he... his orthography is not something that we follow today. We follow more of a Russellian notation. And if you ever get a chance to look at the Begriffsschrift, it's quite interesting the way it's... but it's much less elegant than the Russell's notation. But basically, it's the same thing.
Well, now, just on that note, though, the Begriffsschrift makes the sharp distinction between the tick that gives that indicates the sense of a
There's differences, and that's not
versus the assertion of it. But that that distinction gets dropped, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. That's right.
Okay. And is that dropping significant though, philosophically? In other words, is Frege grasping at something there that?
Well, I think that's his Kantianism coming through, but I don't think anything is none of the power of the logic is lost in the dropping of it.
And when you said the first order, what's being limited by
that? There's only one predicate, not multiple predicates. These are they could be many multiple place predicates, many place predicates, two place predicates, one place predicate. But there's only one predicate. It's not multiple predication.
But if you use conjunction, is that different than multiple predication? You say P and Q?
Yeah, in some ways it is. So,
but I mean, is that not within the bounds of first order predicate calculus to have?
Not within the bounds, but it's just an addition to it. It's not total. It's not something to be added on. So Frege writes the Begriffsschrift in his in order to have the logic powerful enough to do accomplish his program. And he writes, he realizes that he has to get into what we call semantics, get into language in order to continue his project. We got to get a hold of what words mean and get them to kind of fix their meaning or to understand them properly. And so he begins a series of articles on these issues in what's now called philosophy of language, sense and reference, concept and object. And these works are going to deal with these linguistic issues. So he's the father of, he's a mathematician who's has his project in analysis and number theory, but he invents mathematical logic and first-order predicate logic, and he also begins as a father of philosophy of language. Now, it's not to say that other philosophers before Frege or contemporary of him weren't interested in similar types of things. Brentano and Meinong are interested in words. Mill, of course, has in his Systems of Logic, has a chapter on names. And even the American philosopher Peirce does some work in semantics. But he really becomes the father of the analytical approach to semantics, to language. And in this essay, Sense and Reference, he is going to try to correct or have a richer understanding of language, solving with various problems to solve. He begins the essay talking about identity, and he, in the course of his thoughts in this essay, comes up with the famous distinction between the sense of a word or a sentence and its bedeutung, its reference. We'll talk about what that means as we go through the essay. But that's probably enough background to get into the essay. This is published in 1892 in a obscure German journal. And it's read by almost nobody. It makes no impact. But 2 years later, Bertrand Russell finds out about Frege and gets his articles, Frege sent it to him. I believe it was through the auspices of Peano that Frege finds out about Frege.
That Russell finds out.
I'm sorry, that Russell finds out about Frege. And so there's a correspondence, and Frege ends up sending him his work. So Russell was one of the few philosophers of the era, or mathematicians, to pay attention to Frege during his work in the 19th century. Other philosophers come to know Frege later on. Rudolf Carnap is his student, and you hear stories that there were three students in the class, and Frege lectures with his back towards the students, putting these funny marks on the board, and so he's at Jena. It's an important university, but he's not in the center of anything. But Carnap, as I said, takes classes with them. Russell discovers some, and through Russell, Wittgenstein. So some of the greats are influenced him, and through those men, Frege becomes slowly known. But it's not really until, maybe until the 50s and 60s even, that Frege becomes generally known as a important thinker in his own right. And now there's all kinds of studies on Frege. But Russell and Wittgenstein, a little bit later, but Russell and Moore are often considered the fathers of analytical philosophy. But there's some truth to that, but Frege is certainly the grandfather of analytical philosophy. Anyways,
is the interest that started in the 50s and is still going now purely historical, or is it the philosophical issues still being wrestled with as such? I mean, is it more a history of philosophy that's interacting with his work now, or?
Well, there's that aspect, but I'm not sure what the lay of the land is now, but during the 60s and 70s, there was quite a number of Fregians. UCLA, for example, is filled with Fregians.
But, I mean, is that in distinction from being a Russellian? In other words, such that you would not say that Russell or Wittgenstein are everything that Frege was and more?
No, different, because Frege's view of just take one example, his view of sense or thoughts, not the same thing, but Frege is a Platonist. He believes that senses or thoughts are real. Words, take the example of a proper name.
Like the moon.
He believes there is a sense, whereas it has a meaning. Whereas many philosophers reject that view. More materialistically inclined philosophers and say that there is no sense. These are occult objects. And so many philosophers in the analytic tradition back then, and probably even more so now, believe that with Kripke, his father of an alternative theory, more in the Russellian tradition, and that is that the names get their meaning from some causal process, some baptism, some christening. And so there's a causal chain between between the use of the word and when it was first, the verse of a proper name and when it was first used. And so the meaning is not a sense, though the sense of, it may have acquired a certain sense to it, but but that's not really where the proper name gets its meaning, is through its initial baptism.
Well, just to clarify the terminology, the Sinn und Bedeutung, do we translate that as sense and meaning?
Yeah, Bedeutung is usually
reference,
meaning in German, I believe. And sense is a very broad word. It could mean thoughts. Meaning itself. And so, Frege, it's usually translated in English as sense and reference, but I don't believe a Deutung usually has has the same connotation as reference. But it is, I think, the better translation, because in the English, that gives us more of what Frege was after than meaning. In a sense, in a very broad sense, both of these are about meaning. The sense is the meaning of the word in its, we can say, connotative form, and then the Bedeutung is its meaning in its denotative form.
Interesting.
So Frege begins the essay by saying quality. I don't have the German with me, but it's probably not as literally translated as... What is yours? Does it start off with equality or identity?
Equality.
Yeah.
But then there's a Fregean footnote there. At least it's a footnote with a capital A right after the word equality. Does yours have a footnote?
Right. This footnote says, I use the word in the sense of identity. I understand A is identical to B, to have, or A is equal to B. To have the same sense of A is the same as B, or A and B coincide. So he means it as identity, we would say.
The Leibnizian identity?
Mm-hmm. Identity gives rise to challenging questions which are not altogether easy to answer. By the way, this essay is translated by, there's two translators here, Geach and Max Black. I believe Geach translated this one, but
I have Max Black's translation.
Okay, then this piece would be Max Black. So you have the same translation as I do.
You have Black?
Well, it must be, because this is edited by Geach and Black. So I would guess that.
Well, the first sentence you read is identical to in my translation.
Yeah.
We'll see as we go on.
So equality or identity gives rise to challenging questions which are not altogether easy to answer. Is it a relation? A relation between objects, or between names or signs of objects? In my concept writing, I assumed the latter. The reasons, so he assumed that there was a relation between names of objects. The reason which seemed to favor this are the following. A is identical to B, and A is identical to A is identical to A and A is identical to B are obviously statements differing cognitive value. A is identical to A holds a priori, and according to Kant, is to be labeled analytic. While statements of the form A is identical to B often contain very valuable extensions of our knowledge, and cannot always be established a priori. The discovery that the rising sun is not new every morning, but always the same, was one of the most fertile astronomical discoveries. Even today, the re-identification of a small planet or a comet is not always a matter of course. Right, I mean, it was a big and far more recent discovery that Venus, the evening star and the morning star, are one and the same. In fact, this is very tangential, but I don't know, I think he's speculating here, I don't know if man ever discovered that what rises every morning is the same thing. I don't think they ever questioned that. But maybe that's some ignorance I have of the history of human understanding and astronomy, but certainly from the biblical narrative, there was never any question of the sun being the same object every morning.
I mean, even the notion of, was it Apollos that flies across the sky and is the sun?
Mm-hmm.
That implies
Phoebe?
Oh, but whoever the god of the god was that was the son is that god with that name.
Right. So I don't know if this. Maybe you just be speculating the dark prehistorical.
But I mean, another example when he mentions the comet, you know, like when you discover that that little speck up there is indeed Halley's Comet, when before maybe somebody just thought it was another comet.
Right. Well, I mean, this is just a
commonplace,
very tangential thing. But yeah, I mean, we understand the point. But the morning star and the evening star being the same thing was a genuine discovery that we know about. Even today, okay, now, if we were to regard equality or identity as a relation between that which the names A and B designate, it would seem that A is identical to B could not differ from that A is identical to A. That is, provided that A is identical to B is true.
By the way, my translation, whenever you say something is identical to something, mine simply says A equals B.
Right.
You're just reading it that way?
Yeah.
Ah.
A relation would thereby be expressed of a thing to itself, and indeed, one in which each thing stands to itself, but to no other thing. Now, that's obviously, there's something wrong with that. What we apparently want to state is that by A is identical to B is that the signs or names A and B doesn't make the same thing, so that those signs themselves would be under discussion. A relation between them would be asserted. But this relation would hold between the names or signs only insofar as they named or designated something. It would be mediated by the connection of each of the two signs with the same designated thing. But this is arbitrary. Nobody can be forbidden to use any arbitrarily producible event or object as a sign for something. In that case, the sentence A is identical to B would no longer refer to the subject matter, but only to its mode of designation. We would express no proper knowledge by its mean. But in many cases, this is just what we want to do. Okay, well, let's skip a little bit here. A difference can arise only if the difference between the sign and if the difference between the signs corresponds to a difference in the mode of presentation. Let A, B, and C be the lines connecting the vertices of a triangle with the midpoints of the opposite sides. The point of intersection of A and B is the same as the point of intersection of B and C. So we have different designations for the same point. And these names, the point of intersection of A and B, point of intersection of B and C, likewise indicate the mode of presentation. And hence the statement contains actual knowledge. Okay, so he's explaining in a preliminary way how the identity sign doesn't always act in an analytical way, that we can extend our knowledge, but be true. In other words, they're designating the same thing, it's just that they have a different mode of designation, a different way of saying the same thing. And so it obviously is not the same mode of presentation to say that point A, it's not the same as it's a different mode of presentation to say AB than it is BC. You're following different lines to get to the same point. But the reference, or the bedeutung, or the what is being designated is the same thing. It is natural now to think of there being connected with the sign, name, combination of words, written mark, besides that which the sign designates, which may be called the meaning of the sign, and there is the word bedeutung. And so again, it's, you got to be a little careful here in the translation, because often when we think of meaning, we think of what Frege means by sense, but he here is talking about that which is designated, the reference.
Well, my translation keeps the German Bedeutung there.
No. Okay. So that's an advantage.
Yeah. It seems like we almost should stipulate that we're going to just use that word. But we can't if your translator didn't.
Okay, we may call the meaning of the sign or the deutung of the sign. Or I'm going to, actually what I'm going to do instead of, I'm just going to say reference to try to avoid some confusions here.
What does your translation call it, though?
Meaning. So whenever there's the word bedeutung, I'm just going to use reference.
Okay.
Which we may call the reference of the sign. Also, what I should like to call... let me start this over. It is now natural now to think of there being connected with a sign, or a name, or whatever, besides that which the sign designates, which is the reference of bedeutung, also what I should like to call the sense, or the zin, of the sign, wherein the mode of presentation is contained. And so the meaning, in my translation, the reference, is the object, and then the sense is contains the mode of presentation. In our example, accordingly, the meaning of the expression, the point of the intersection of A and B and the point of intersection of B and C would be the same. And already going against my rule, the bedeutung, the reference of the expression, the point of intersection of A and B and the point of intersection of B and C would be the same, but not their sen or their zin, sense or their zin. The meaning of evening star would be the same. Again, I don't, I'm being tricked here because I don't have the German, but I know he uses the bedeutung there. The bedeutung of evening star would be the same as that of morning star, but not the sense. Okay, so evening star, morning star designate the same thing, but the mode of presentation is quite different. Right? They have different meanings, different zen.
Well, there's a interesting difference between these two examples, though, and that is that the evening star being the same as the morning star as to referent is contingent in the sense that the universe could have been constructed in such a way that they were not the same. Whereas it almost seems like this geometrical example, at least on the assumption of Euclidean geometry, you can, you know, deduce rigorously that the points are the same. So in a sense you could almost argue that a priori, those two meanings are the same. Whereas you can't do that in the case of the evening and morning star.
Sure, but that's not going to be, I believe, important because for what Frege is doing here.
Well, that's why it might be that why Frege's thing is powerful, because it can span both the a priori type of identity and the a posteriori type of identity. But I mean, mightn't somebody come back and say that since in the geometrical case you can logically deduce one from the other, that in some sense they have the same sense and bedeutung?
No. Because point B, A, B and point B, C do in fact have a different mode of presentation. You get to them the same, different way. In other words, you trace line A and you trace line B. Granted, there's the same one line remains constant throughout, but those lines get you to point, we call it point Z. It's exact in a different way than the other way, BC. So the mode of presentation, even in that example, is quite different. And so the epistemological issues are not going to, I don't think, be an important. It is clear from the context that by sign and name, I have here understood any designation figuring as a proper name, which thus has its meaning, or
Bedeutung, a definite object, this word taken in the widest range, but not a concept or relation, which shall be discussed further in another article, and that's this concept and object essay. The designation of a single object can also consist of several words or other word or other signs. For brevity, let every such designation be called the proper name.
So in other words, the point given by this AB line, that whole phrase functions as a proper name.
Right.
Okay.
The sense of a proper name is grasped by everyone who is sufficiently familiar with the language or totality of designations to which it belongs. But this serves to illustrate only a single aspect of the thing meant, supposing it to have one. So, what he's saying here is that the Zen is grasped by anybody who is a competent speaker of the language. He says this only illuminates a single aspect of the thing met, or the thing referred to, supposing it has one. So on the supposition that it has a reference, right, the Golden Mountain has a meaning, has a sense, but it fails to have an object or reference. Fails to refer. So he says, just suppose that it does have a reference, something that it does refer to. He says that the sense only, or the Zen only illuminates one aspect of the thing meant. Which you can understand in one sense as the meaning of something, right? It is only one aspect of the meaning of something. Comprehensive knowledge of the thing meant would require us to be able to say immediately whether any given sense attaches to it. To such knowledge we never attain.
Well, that sentence I find a bit enigmatic. What does he mean that we never attain to that knowledge?
Well, I mean, example from modern physics, I may be deficient in my, behind in my physics, but take something like a muon, or you go back in history and talk about an atom, you know, when the atomic theory first is being developed. Of course, this is something that's quite revolutionary in the history of physical thought, and the people that were beginning to put forward an atomic theory didn't know if an atom is something that is an object in the world. And so he's saying we just never know. I mean, if we had comprehensive knowledge, we would know immediately if our proper names had designations of reference. They referred to an object.
Well, but let's take a more mundane example, you know, like the evening star that he already mentioned. I mean, he seems to be denying that we would know whether our term, the evening star, actually refers to a real planet. Called Venus. Or Mercury, I guess. I forgot which one it is.
Venus. Well, no, I mean, one sense, yes, if we didn't have comprehensive knowledge, we would, in that case, we would not know. Because we'd think it was different than the morning star. In other words, if we knew the had knowledge of the thing meant, comprehensively, then all we have to do is, you know, search our meanings and find out what that the object is and whether it has an object.
Well, I guess,
but in cases where we're not sure, or cases where we're just ignorant, like the those in the previous eras that didn't know they were the same thing, they couldn't just search their meaning because they didn't have comprehensive knowledge.
Well, I mean, maybe the stumbling block for me is when he says any given sense attaching to it. By that, I took him to mean we don't even know if a single sense attaches to it. But it's he's saying instead we don't have a knowledge of all senses.
Right.
So in other words, he's not denying that this or that sense.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
He's saying all of its meanings we don't attain to.
Right.
I see.
The regular connection between a sign, its sense, and what it means, and those, remember, are three things we have to keep separated, right? You could have a sign with no sense to it, right? I could put some scribble on the board, and unless I gave it a meaning, a sense, let this stand for dog or something like that, or the teacher of Plato, then it would be a sign without a sense. Although, really, they're in some sense, there really are no signs without senses, because becoming a sign, we must distinguish signs from non-signs by them having some type of sense. Otherwise, they wouldn't be a sign of anything. But anyways, it's conceptually distinct. And then the reference, you can have something that is meaningful, a sign that is meaningful, but has no designation. The golden mountain has a meaning, but no reference. So the regular connection between a sign, its sense, and what it means is of such a kind that to the sign there corresponds a definite sense, and to that, in turn, a definite thing meant. Right? Remember, he's talking about proper names now. So, now he's going to extend this out to strings of words, to sentences as well, but now he's talking about proper names. So the connection between a sign of a proper name, its sense, and what it means is of such a kind that to the sign there corresponds a definite sense, and to that in turn a definite thing meant. While to a given thing meant, an object, there does not belong only a single sign. In other words, you can use different signs of objects. Right? I mean, the example he gave previously.
Right.
A, B, B, C. Mm-hmm. The same sense has different expressions in different languages, or even in the same language. To be sure, exceptions to this regular behavior occur. To every expression belonging to a complete totality of signs, in other words, natural languages can be quite messy. To every expression belonging to a complete totality of signs, there should certainly correspond a definite sense. But natural language often do not satisfy this condition, and one must be content that the same word has the same sense in the same context. It may perhaps be granted that every grammatically well-formed expression figuring as a proper name always has sense. And this is one of the areas in which Frege's theory of names is going to be different than the Russellian theory of names. Frege just says we're going to take it for granted that they're going to have a sense. And he also takes, in his logic, he also takes for granted that it's going to have a reference as well.
Now, what about a what's commonly thought of as a proper name, like Joe? I mean, doesn't that leap straight from the sign to the Deutung without any sense in between?
Yeah, that's been one of the debates, but no, Frege says it has a sense. And he pretty much says that it has a single sense. Now, later philosophers in a kind of Fregean tradition will say that, well, it has more than a sense. It has a cluster of senses or meanings. And so they've refined it a bit. But Frege says it's going to have just one sense. Well, they say that, well, but Joe can be used to, you know, designate Joe Namath or or Joe DiMaggio. But the context there is going to determine that.
Well, yeah, but that's not what I was highlighting so much as, you know, when you speak of the evening star, you the sense of that is this object that I see in the evening near the horizon. When the sun sets, it's kind of a descriptive. So intuitively, that has a sense. Mm-hmm. Whereas Joe, Joe is not a description. Joe is just a pure name.
Right.
Whereas Frege seems to be conflating he's calling these descriptions names, but also a proper name is a name.
Right. So he does believe there's a sense attached to it.
But the sense there is a little less intuitive, at least.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot less intuitive. But he says that in order to get to the object, he believes in order to get the object, you have to have a mode of designation, and that is going to be by means of the sense of the sign. So it's going to have a sense.
So the sense of Joe, I suppose, would be something like a word we use to refer to an individual human being that's been picked out.
Or the son of Frank.
I suppose so.
Or the when the question is, well, what if it turns out, you know, no matter what you give it as its sense, what if it turns out that Joe discovers that, you know, Frank adopted him and he's really a bastard? Well, then that wasn't its sense, was it? So what was its sense? Well, that's why later philosophers of language have helped Frege along as well. It has a cluster of meanings, right? The son of Frank, who is a pro football player, add various things to it.
For the Jets that defeated the Colts in 1968.
Yeah, so it has all these things attached to it. The wife, the husband of Doris or whatever, the father of Dick and Jane. In other words, there's more to it than just a single thing. So in that case, in the cluster concept, if one of them proves to be false, well, that's okay. There's other things involved. It's not him pinned upon one thing. But Frege thinks it has one sense. He's never very clear on what that sense is, by the way. But it does have a sense. So you have to take it on faith at this point.
Yeah, it's a little interesting because the sense, even from the illustration you just gave, the sense that a particular speaker thinks is his sense could prove to be erroneous.
Sure.
And yet it would still connect to the proper object.
Right, and that's one of the advantages of the causal theory of names, because Kripke's argument is, yeah, we may get it completely wrong, and yet really be getting toward to the object, because we are speakers that are using the language competently, and that name is fixed. He calls names rigid designators. That name is fixed by the initial use of it, and when we use that word, that's what we're going back to. But this is not to say that to the sense there always corresponds a thing meant. The words, a celestial body most distant from the sun, have a sense, but it's very doubtful if there is also a thing they mean.
Now, by that, does he mean it would not, by saying it's doubtful if it has a bedeutung, the celestial body most distant from the earth, is he supposing that, for example, the universe is infinitely extended, so there's more and more, for any object you would pick out as the bedeutung of that phrase, there's another one even further, therefore there is no one?
Yeah, Frege is almost always uses the most, one thing you'll learn to love about Frege is the examples he gives are so crystallizing of what he's talking about, but he could have probably picked another one. I mean, you could say the greatest prime number would be probably a better example, right? And what is it? It's who's there is it? Oh, I forget the. Oh, Goldbach's conjecture. That, which, as far as I know, still hasn't been proved, and that is that there is no greatest prime number. We certainly have a sense, the greatest prime number, but it may not have a bedeutung. And so, you're just saying that words can have, proper names can have a sense, but that doesn't guarantee it has a reference.
Interesting.
The expression, the least rapidly convergent series, has a sense, but demonstrably, well, okay, I shouldn't have, it's been a while since I've read Frege, so I spoke too soon that this wasn't a happy illustration, because he comes right back and gives us one, right? The expression, the least rapidly convergent series, has a sense, but demonstrably, there's nothing it means, since for every given convergent series, another convergent, but less rapidly convergent series can be found.
But it almost seems like one could object that once you understand the theory of convergent series, and you understand that there is no series that is the least convergent series, it seems like one might say that therefore the speaking of the least rapidly convergent series does not have sense.
Oh no, it's false. I mean, it's... To say, to predicate anything that would be false, unless, well, that's not true. You could say the least rapidly convergent series is an impossibility, I mean, which would be a true. But to assert anything of it other than something like that would make it turn into a falsehood. But it certainly has a sense. I mean, nobody would say, I don't understand what you mean by that.
Well, what if I said that negative number which is greater than one? Would that have a sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If that has a sense, then I'll buy the other one having a sense.
Yeah, that's...
But to me, that almost doesn't have sense. It's
well,
almost nonsense.
Yeah, let me be cautious here. I mean, let's take a more easier example. Well, I think the problem here is the ambiguity of the word sense in English. Because we'd say, well, it really makes, if you understand that you wouldn't say that it was false. You'd say it was nonsense. Let me think. Mm-hmm. Okay, the sum of two negative numbers greater than the number which is a sum of two negative numbers that is greater than zero. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I'll have to bookmark that then.
Yeah, it almost seems like a distinction between entities which, upon further investigation, might prove to not have a Bedeutung. I mean, it seems like we have a simple intuition versus a complex intuition or something like that. I mean, if you picture the idea of, you know, that negative number which is greater than zero seems like an immediate contradiction. But, you know, if you think of, like, say, God or, like, a very powerful mind, even, might not this thing about convergent series be just as obvious as, you know, almost just as intuitively nonsensical as saying that the negative number which is greater than zero? Well, let's bookmark it, but that's...
Yeah, whatever the case, we know what the illustration...
I can follow his argument.
Yeah, I mean, the illustration helps us understand what he means, that a proper name can have a sense without a reference. In grasping a sense, one is not certainly assured of meaning anything. If words are used in the ordinary way, what one intends to speak of is what they mean.
You're starting a new paragraph after that last one?
Right.
Okay.
That's a bit controversial, but it can also happen, however, that one wishes, which Kripke makes a point of this too. I mean, people can intend to speak of something, but that is not what they mean. But there's no point in beclouding the issues with objections later until we get to Frege's theory. It can also happen, however, that one wishes to talk about the words themselves or their sense. So this is something like the distinction between use of a word and mentioning it, right? We can talk about words themselves or their sense. This happens, for example, when the words of another are quoted. One's own words then first designate words of the other speaker, and only the latter have their usual meaning. Now, this introduces medievals called the oratio obliqua, right? Indirect reference or indirect speech is what he's talking about. Right? So anything type of propositional attitude clauses, right? I believe that, or John, well, indirect speeches, he said, John said, then you quote them there. And what you're doing is you're talking about what he said, but, and you're quoting exactly what he said, but the meaning of them, that is not going to be the same as that of the original speaker because of the context in which it's embedded in. One's own words then first designate the words of the other speaker, and only the latter have their usual meaning. Now, this is going to turn out to be a problem for Frege, and we'll get there in a few pages. One's own words then first designate words of the other speaker. Okay, we then have signs of signs. In writing the words are in this case enclosed in quotation marks. Accordingly, a word standing between quotation marks must not be taken as having its ordinary meaning.
Bedeutung.
Right, it's ordinary Bedeutung. So, I mean, the example that Quine gives is, he makes it a little more complicated than this, but I'll simplify it for our purposes. Boston is a word that contains six letters, and Boston is a town that contains about 600,000 residents. Right, and the first, if we were writing it out, we'd have Boston in quotation marks, single quotes, and the second one with no quotes. And so one is being mentioned. You're talking about the word Boston. The sign is not the same thing, right? Because the quotation marks show you that it's a different sign and therefore has a different sense than the word without quotation marks. In order to speak of the sense of an expression A, one may simply use the phrase the sense of the expression A. In this direct speech, one talks about the sense, for example, of another person's remarks. It is quite clear that in this way of speaking, words do not have their customary meaning, but designate what is usually their sense. In order to have a short expression, we will say, in indirect speech, words are used indirectly or have their indirect reference. We distinguish accordingly the customary from the indirect meaning of the word and its customary sense from its indirect sense. The indirect meaning of the word is accordingly its customary sense, or the indirect reference of a word is accordingly its customary sense. Such exceptions must also be borne in mind in the mode of connection between sign, sense, and meaning. In particular cases, and meaning in particular cases is to be correctly understood, if the mode is to be correctly understood. Okay, so what he's saying here is, in indirect speech, you have a different sense than the original speaker's words. But Frege's view here is that the sign in the second one, in the first one, has some Bedeutung. But in indirect speech, that same sign does not have the same Bedeutung, but its Bedeutung is the sense of the word which was not in the indirect speech, or the phrase in the indirect speech. And so there's a connection between the two, but they don't have the same meaning or Bedeutung or same reference.
Well, now, in other words, if I say, John said unicorns live on Mars. Well, when John said it, unicorns live on Mars, he was making an assertion with, and the Bedeutung was unicorns, of the word unicorn. Whereas when I say John said unicorns live on Mars, I'm not doing that, but I'm portraying a meaning that I'm attributing to John's assertion, but I'm not making any connection between an assertion about unicorns.
Right. So, the first one is almost certainly false, and the second one is true, if it's reported correctly.
Because all I'm talking about is the sense of the word unicorn as being something that was asserted by John.
Right.
Okay.
And so the connection, the beauty of the theory is that because the oratio oblique versus the oratio recta, right, the direct speech, is going to have some connection. The meaning is going to have some connection. And so he has a very nice way of showing how one could be true, the other false, how one can have a different reference than the other, and yet there is some connection because the original Bedeutung becomes the indirect sense, or the sense of the indirect speech. Now, I don't want to get into the problems of Frege too quickly, but you can see how this is going to lead to problems, or at least to a great inflation of senses, because you can embed things in indirect speech to as many orders as you'd like. John said that Peter said that unicorns live on Mars. Well, once you embed it twice, then you're going to have another sense. You're going to have, well, this is somewhat controversial, but Frege seems to be committed that, to, and some Fregeans disagree with this. Not only they disagree with it themselves, they can either view themselves as correcting Frege, or Frege never intended this, but he seems to intend this. At least it seems to flow out of what he says. But we have as a multiplication of senses infinitely, right? Because if the direct speech refers to an object, the indirect speech refers to the sense of the direct speech, and then the second order indirect speech, John said that, Peter said, you're going to have the sense of that, the reference of that being the sense of the first order embedded indirect speech, which now is the sense of that. And so now you have you're removed two degrees away from the direct speech. And so what is the sense, or what is the sense of the Bedeutung of the indirect speech? Well, now you have a multiplication of senses.
Well, I mean, I think I would rush to Frege's defense here by suggesting that you don't, that doubly cascaded sentence use of the unicorn, for example, or whatever it is that John asserted, is still just the indirect Bedeutung at that second quote. In other words, why not just say this is a binary thing? No matter how many indirections you use, it's just the indirect Bedeutung.
Well, the reason to say that, and that may be what Frege, if he thought about it, would say, but it doesn't really flow out of his theory, because there are, it becomes embedded a second time. And so you're not talking about what John said, you're talking about what Paul said that John said. Well, so now you're referring to Paul, what Paul said, that's your primary indirect speech, to speak grammatically ugly. And that is what Frege is explaining here seems to be something quite different than simply reporting what John said.
Right, but I mean, what's being rescued by this distinction is that I'm abandoning responsibility for a referent of the word, or a Bedeutung of the word. But it's the assertion that I'm simply, the meaning of an assertion that I'm reporting someone else to have asserted. To me, it seems like that distinction still is
at the same level when I say that John said, that Peter said, that, in other words, as long as I've rescued my speech from my use of a assertive referent, then it seems like this distinction is still clear. Or maybe you could take a different tack and say that when I say John said that Paul said P, the whole sentence John said P is Q, which John said. In other words, maybe the way to do it would be to...
Well, if you do it that way, then... Okay, so John speaking, he's asserted P. Then I say John asserted P, and you're calling that sentence Q. Well, then I could say, if I said Paul said Q, which is John asserted
P. Right, right.
Then that's something that's going to be, that's something different. And so the Q there is not the Q of the first sentence. It's not going to have the same reference as the original sentence.
But now when we pick apart the Q and the P, they each have some word in them. Unicorn, for example. Which, in the assertion of the original speaker, had an intended bedeutung, but all the different subsequent layers simply are reporting that meaning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we need to do is clean up a bit is the intention of the speaker and things like that, and those are going to clutter it up a bit. I mean, if you meant simply by that John spoke it seriously, you know, if he wasn't joking, oh yeah, there's unicorns on Mars. I mean, that's one thing, but in terms of if you say intended meaning, then that gets you into a realm of language or meaning that Frege isn't too concerned with at this point. Here.
Well, so I mean, but if John merely said that there are unicorns on Mars is a meaningful concept or predicate, although I'm not asserting it, then it almost seems like unicorn doesn't I'm having a hard time removing intention here, because the intention is to assert it, and that's what makes it have what one is asserting to have the bedeutung, namely connect to an object which is a unicorn on Mars. I mean, I thought that was exactly the distinction that's being made here. So that's what I'm still struggling with. I mean,
well, in his example, he's assuming that it's an assertion, not just a mere thought.
Right.
Of there being unicorns on Mars.
Hey, right.
Here's a thought. There are unicorns on Mars, where he's not asserting it. He's assuming that they're asserting it.
And it's in the act of asserting it that the asserter is intending, temporarily use that word, a bedeutung to what would otherwise have a mere sense.
Yeah, but this is your Hegelianism coming out again, I think.
Well, it could be, but that's why I need to get it ironed out then. Because otherwise, without that, what is this distinction between Sinn and bedeutung? So John is wronged in his bedeutung is false. But if he didn't intend it to be true or to be an assertion of the case, then we lose the bedeutung, it seems like.
Well, okay, let's do this. Well, Let's come back to this criticism.
Okay.
And fill out his, for lack of better terms, theory of meaning.
Okay.
Okay, just remember in Frege's discussion here, we have a sign, we have a sense, and we have a reference. And we'll just say that all signs have a sense, but not all senses have a reference. So there's an obvious, even if it's a logically perfect language, there's still a conceptual distinction between them. One is the mode of designation, the other one is the object. The meaning of sense, the meaning and sense, or the sin, the bedeutung and zin of a sign, are to be distinguished from the associated idea.
First of them.
Right, it gives. Now, what he means by that is ideas that come up in your mind that you associate with it. Now, I'll give you a very banal example. The proper name George Bush, right? And you could have associated with it greatest modern president of the United States, or bumbling idiot, or something in between, right? You can have different associated ideas with it. And that's not something that is going to have any role in meaning. This is not, meaning is something that is objective. If you use the word properly, two people use the same word, proper name, use it properly, then whatever their associated ideas with it doesn't matter. They have the same sense and the same reference. If what a sign means is an object perceivable by the senses, my idea of it is an internal image arising from memories of sense impressions which I have had and acts both internal and external which I have performed. Such an idea is often imbued with feeling. The clarity of its separate parts varies and oscillates. The same sense is not always connected, even in the same man, with the same idea. The idea is subjective. One man's idea is not that of another. The results, as a matter of course, are a variety of differences in the ideas associated with the same sense. A painter, a horseman, and a zoologist is an example of his great use of examples. A painter, a horseman, and a zoologist will probably connect different ideas with the name Bucephalus. This constitutes an essential distinction between the idea and the sign sense, which may be the common property of many people, and so is not a part or a mode of the individual mind. But one can hardly deny that mankind has a common store of thoughts, which has transmitted from one generation to another, whereas ideas change, right? You can call this the coloring of something. Now it shows right here that Frege is something of a Platonist, right? I mean, the senses are the same, even if one person has a different colors in a different way. So there's different feelings or attitudes or ideas associated with it than another. The sense is still the same throughout. It's always going to be the same. Now, of course, you can take the sign and give it a different sense. I mean, we can always do that. But if we're talking about senses themselves, they always are the same, no matter who's using them. They're not the property of any mind. Now, this is different, of course, from many other theories of meaning. The empiricists would differ on this, of course. But to Frege, and this is where one area that he influences Wittgenstein even in his later theory, that there's not these sense is not something that is internal to an individual. It's not something that comes from their ideas. Sense is something that is goes beyond that. Now, you don't have to turn to Platonism here. I mean, Wittgenstein, in his later views, wasn't a Platonist. But the meaning of a word was not based upon somebody's own personal ideas of it. It's based upon the community of speakers. So you can go that route. But Frege is a Platonist. He believes that there are things called senses that we grasp. I don't know if we used that word yet, but a very Platonic word, right? We grasp senses. They exist.
But his argument here seems to be that, I mean, let's bring it to earth. I mean, so there's a sense to the word horse, for instance. But here he seems to be highlighting the fact that when I use the word horse...
Well, he's using a name of a particular horse.
Well, I guess it would apply to the... Well, this example he gives is a name, but...
Yeah, so let's stick with names here.
So Bucephalus is a mythical horse, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with Bucephalus, but let's say Bellerophon.
I don't know that one. How about Dumbo?
Okay, Dumbo.
That was the elephant, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I picture kind of a goofy, you know, elephant that's clumsy, maybe, and you're picturing a noble beast of the jungle. That's what I take to be these different forced elements. In other words,
right.
we can't use a word without picturing it somehow.
Right.
And there's a subjectivity there.
Well, we can.
Okay, but say we are picturing it.
Right.
Just to make this concrete. But yet there's a subjective thing that you and I can't hold our subjective Vorstellung or imagination or presentation or idea of Dumbo together to prove that it's identical. There's an opaqueness. But then his argument seems to be that nonetheless we can say that there's a single sense,
right,
that we both share in, but the argument for that is fairly perfunctory here. He says that it's almost a transcendental argument. He's at the end, he says, well, it must be that there's a sense, because,
well,
if there weren't, we couldn't transmit knowledge from one generation to another.
Well, that's
but
right.
But we have transmitted knowledge from one generation.
Well, that's right. It is.
So that's his proof, that there's a single sense, even though he's granting that our subjective Vorstellung, and there's no way to determine if those are identical.
That's right. So his argument is basically, it's not really even, I mean, you could call it a transcendental argument, basically. Yeah, we know it can't be the ideas because those are different, and if that were the case, then we could never really communicate with one another because we, you know, it would be only an accident if we had these same ideas as one another. So yeah, that can't be the conveyor of meaning. Our ideas cannot be. If they were, we couldn't have any assurance at all that we're ever communicating.
But the transcendental...
But we know we're communicating, and therefore, that's not... Those ideas are not vehicles of meaning. They're not carrying any of the meaning.
Right, okay. So in other words, we either have to give up talking about anything, but once we're able to talk about things meaningfully, we've proven that there is such a thing as...
Right, if we want to turn a transcendental argument, you say, well, then... You mean there's always a skeptical question, right? Well, maybe we aren't. Well, I mean, I guess the one answer to that is, well, then we're not even this, even this objection is, on that view, impossible. Because it assumes that we are speaking about the same thing.
Interesting.
In the light of this, one need have no scruples in speaking simply of the sense. So he says, in light of this, because of this, we don't have to talk about senses of the word, ideas, but the sense, as an objective thing. Whereas in the case of an idea, one must, strictly speaking, add whom it belongs to, and at what time. Right, so my idea of Bellerophon, well, you know, the idea of a Bellerophon is something that doesn't exist out there, right? You always have to say, well, whose idea of Bellerophon? Well, my idea of Bellerophon. But the sense of Bellerophon is not something we have to ask, well, whose sense of Bellerophon are you talking to? I'm talking about. The sense of Bellerophon is something, if you speak the language, you know. Where's okay?
So, I mean, are we forced to say that the sense is a refinement of our Vorstellung or idea?
No. No.
The idea is bigger than the sense?
No.
Or has
no, because
additions to it that aren't important to it?
No, the idea may have no connection to the sense.
Well, better have a connection if we're going to go back and say that we are really talking about something that's real or that's objective, that's singular.
Why?
Otherwise, knowledge couldn't be passed from generation one generation to the next.
Well,
as he says.
Well, okay. I think you spoke. Either I misunderstood you or you misspoke. I thought you said there has to be a connection between the idea and the sense.
Well, the idea is what I have when I'm using the sense.
No, that's accidental. You don't have to have an idea.
Well, I took him to be saying that
we often have associate ideas. That doesn't mean we always have associated ideas.
Well, I
think about the greatest prime number. I don't have any associated idea with that. At least, if I did, it'd be completely, completely accidental. I mean, completely. So, you know, with empirical things, if we're talking about mountains or rivers or people, then there's often associated ideas with them.
Well, let's limit it to that just for a moment. On those types of things, it seems like you have to have a Vorstellung, otherwise you're not talking about anything. It seems like the Vorstellung is the private, that which is being referred to with the meaning of the word.
No, it's not being referred to at all, but it's what,
or it's being,
it's what's coming up in your mind as you're speaking.
But if nothing came up when you were speaking of something physical or empirical, how could you say you were talking about anything?
Well, if you think about it a moment, when you talk about everyday lives, it's over on the desk there. I mean, when you use the word desk, is always an image popped up in your mind? I mean, oftentimes it's not. Now, if you thought about it, yeah, desk, okay, you may have a particular desk in mind. You might conjure that up, but I would say most of what we speak about, we don't have conjure up images.
But when you try to cash it out, it eventually has to, I would say. Like if you say, go get the, would you go in and grab my pipe that's on the desk? Initially, I might not have a Vorstellung of the desk, but if I came into the office and started groping around on the bookshelves looking for the pipe, something is broken down.
Well,
I have to compare these objects with
what's
some.
What's broken down is that you don't understand the language. Because.
But how do I find the desk without comparing it to that? When the need arises, at least, then I do picture some sort of family resemblance of objects that I would identify as desks, as opposed to bookshelves.
Okay, well, let's go back, and I want to try to understand what you're saying. You're saying that. You see, you're arguing that the idea is always a part of the meaning?
Well, no, not only at the subjective nexus. In other words, that
this goes back to my Hegelianism, I guess, but I can't imagine using a word meaningfully without having an associated idea.
Well, let's grant that.
And that idea, so then if I ask what's the relationship between that idea and the Vorstellung, then I was just raising the question whether the meaning is sort of like a distillation, like sort of the abstraction of, you know, that which is really almost a Platonic form, you know, that which is, when you remove all the unnecessary. I always thought desks were brown, and I discovered that that's wrong. So, but my sense of desk rises above that, and I now realize that the brownness wasn't really part of the sense of desk, even though my Vorstellung was wrong initially.
Well, right. I mean, that's what Frege would say. There's nothing. That doesn't cut anything against anything that Frege would say.
Yeah, I don't think anything that I'm saying really is trying to refute Frege. I guess I was just apropos nothing, wondering if. I guess it's not important to him to try to identify what the relation is between the Vorstellung and idea. But it almost sounds like you're saying there's no relation between them. But I can't conceive of that. I can't conceive of what that would. How that would work. How could I ever use a...
Well, what I meant is name. That there's no... no necessary relationship between them. In the sense that you can... your imagination can be... I mean, think of it in, you know, Berkeley's criticism of Locke. You know, where you get the meaning of dog by abstracting from all dogs the essence of dogness, right? The thing that's true of all things. You have a picture of kind of pure dogness. Well, Berkeley says, well, that's ridiculous. And you're always thinking of a particular dog. So if you conjure up, you know, if you conjure up an image of a desk, you're always conjuring up an image of a particular desk. Whether the desk that you're referring to meets up to that or not. When I talk about the desk, I may conjure up a different image of it, which may be more accurate, less accurate than your image. But we can still, whatever our images are, we can still, even if we have different images, we can still communicate about the desk. Because the sense has no is something different than the images that are conjured up about it.
It seems like if you were... there's lots of images that people could have with the sense of desk, but they couldn't... they're not allowed to have just any image, because then they've strayed away from a notion of deskness.
Well, there's probably certain limitations. I mean, if you and I are talking about George Bush, we could have, you know, I mean, if it came out that the image you conjure up was a, you know, an animal living at SeaWorld, then that's just like, oh no, no, not that, you know, that, not that George Bush. You know, the intellectually inferior one that's the current president of the United States. That George Bush I'm talking about. So, yeah, I mean, at a certain level, I'd say, yeah, I mean, you. So we'd be talking about, we'd obviously be using the word indifference. Different senses than that. If we wouldn't be using the same word, it's only an accident that the dolphin at SeaWorld and the President of the United States are called George Bush, or simply George. So George is having a bad day. Yeah, I know. It's, you know, he's not doing his tricks right. No, no, no. I'm talking about another George.
Another set of tricks.
Right.
Well, I'm willing to move on with this proviso. I mean, would you grant that I could read Frege this way to say that there's only one sense, but every subjective idea is probably different, or at least we could never establish that they're identical. Yet there must be some relation between each person's sense and, or image rather, idea, and the sense, or knowledge could not be passed from generation, just like he made a slightly different point in the previous paragraph. But that relation is so complicated and ambiguous that we can't really nail it down, and we'll bracket that whole issue for the time being. We don't really know, we can't really describe what the exact relationship is between the idea and the sense. But that if there was no relationship, it would also not be possible for knowledge to be passed from.
Well, I mean, let's go back. I mean, he says, such an idea is often imbued with feeling. The clarity of its separate parts varies and oscillates. So if we take it on, so Frege seems to be talking more about the, not just the image, but the kind of the associative feelings with that thing. You know, snake, I mean, a like or dislike. And that's completely adventitious. It's not.
Oh, that's true. I'll grant that.
So now in the empirical stuff, yeah, I mean, there, Frege's point, I mean, Frege may say, yeah, I mean, if somebody's conjuring up completely different images of one of the human being, another of a rock, then yeah, I mean, they're not talking about the same thing. And so, you know, so, and so, yeah, there may be some, you know, certain level. You just can't conjure up any image. But then again, I mean, you could conjure, you could talk about George Bush, the president, and conjure up the image of, I mean, not to pick on the current president, but of a chimpanzee, right? A chimp. Well, you conjure up that image, and you're still talking about George Bush. So,
but not in the most general sense. Not if the chimp turns out to be just some chimp in the jungles of Nairobi, or I mean of Kenya or something.
Well, but you're not talking about any particular chimp. You're just conjuring up an image as you're speaking about George Bush.
But if my image does not eventually connect to a human being residing from time to time in the White House, et cetera, then well, I don't have the same sense as you do.
Yeah, but I'd say that, going back to what I said earlier, that's just, oh yeah, well, I meant this George, not that George. Oh, okay. You know, and if you have enough knowledge of the language and have enough knowledge about current affairs, then, you know, we get on the same page. In other words, it's not the image that's the problem. It's just we were using different senses and therefore conjuring up different images. But let's just take Frege.
Okay.
As well, I mean, the basic point is, seems to be incontrovertible, and that is, even if we, on your argument, well, we have to conjure, if we're using the same word, then, if we're using the same sense, then you have to conjure up some similar image. Though I won't grant that. Where was I going to go with this? I mean, his general point is that, yeah, we're never going to have the exact same image of something. At least, it's highly unlikely. We certainly would never know. You know, even if we said, well, this is what I conjure up, you know, in all the details, we'd never know if they're...
Right, because you could never enumerate them. for one thing.
So, I mean, his point is that that obviously isn't, the ideas aren't carrying the meaning with it. The senses, this thing that he calls a sense, that's why we're able to communicate.
All right.
Okay.
Let's bracket that and move on.
But there still remains a difference in, okay, so just as one man connects this idea and another, that idea, with the same word, so also one man can associate this sense and another, that sense. But there still remains a difference in the mode of connection. They are not prevented from grasping the same sense, but they cannot have the same idea. Si duo idem acuant, non est idem. If two two things were the same, identical, not, it is not identical.
Oh, I think he's saying if
two things,
if two people make one thing, it still isn't the same.
Yeah, if two do not make the same thing, it is not the same thing.
It's a little opaque, but just saying the same thing as the previous paragraph, I think. You and I project the same.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right, yeah, right. If two people do the same thing, it is not the same thing. If two people
again, the fact that you're and my Vorstellungen are not the same, even though we're somehow creating the same sense.
If two persons picture the same thing, each still has his own idea.
Right.
It is indeed sometimes possible to establish differences in the ideas, or even in the sensations of different men. But an exact comparison is not possible, because we cannot have both ideas together in the same consciousness.
So, I mean, would it be fair to say that this essay could have, the title of this essay, instead of making a twofold distinction, could have made a threefold distinction?
No, because he's talking about meaning, and ideas have no bearing upon meaning. In other words, he's making a threefold distinction. I mean, if you add sign, you have a fourfold distinction. So they're certainly all distinct, but since ideas aren't going to play any role in Frege's theory of meaning, then he's not.
Alarm's going off. Thank you. Last time you used this, was it working?
Yeah. Yeah, I even logged in.
It was... Before...
It was before dinner.
Yeah, but
it was 6 o'clock-ish.
6 o'clock, 6:15.
I remember it was 6:15.
No, it was 4 o'clock.
Okay, so then Kevin came, and then...
That's right. I think I just came up with a a tangential observation here on this point of the threefold distinction. If you drew the word Bedeutung, Sinn, and Idea on the chalkboard, you know, Frege wants to draw this thick black line separating, you know, the subjective of the idea from the Sinn and the Bedeutung. And he's not going to concern himself with this subjective aspect underneath the black line.
Well,
whereas Husserl and the phenomenologists are exactly concerned with that, crossing that line. And in that critique that Frege gives of Husserl, that seems to be exactly what he's trying to drive home. No, forget all that subjective stuff.
Right.
I mean, I think this is actually the continental divide between the continent and the analytical school, right there.
Well, it's one example of it, right.
Yeah. So he's aware of it. He's aware of the subjective aspect.
Well, sure.
But he's doing his best to remove that from being necessary to analyze further. For the sake of a theory of meaning.
Right.
Whereas Husserl is going to say, well, you missed everything important if you don't tie it to the subjective acts.
And there's going to be some analytical philosophers that do, well, I mean, Meinong and Brentano are in the continental tradition, and they're interested in the subjective acts. But some later analytical philosophers, Meinong and Brentano, in their theory of intentionality becomes important. So there is some revisiting of some of these issues later on.
And this is why the continentalists are always accusing the Anglo-Americans of being naive, because they think that the really important questions are just being bracketed and shoved under the carpet. And
conversely, the
Anglo-Americans say that they're obscurantist by clouding meaning with all of this subjective stuff. Fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, it's an example of the divide. It's not the whole of the divide, but yeah, they're dealing with issues that are go way beyond the... either our ability to know, or they are dealing with issues that aren't important to the topic at hand. Just tangential. They're interested in the subjective, which is not essential to, in this case, the theory of meaning. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. The meaning of the proper name is the object itself. So again, the reference of the proper name is the object itself, which we designate by using it. The idea which we have in that case is wholly subjective. In between lies the sense, which is indeed no longer subjective like an idea, but is yet not the object itself. So he does say in between, which makes it sound like, well, it's this middle thing that connects both of them. But I don't think that's how he really intends to use the word in between. He just means that it's not the object, and it's not the idea either. And so this is something that he is introducing. In other words, other theorists, philosophers would have said that, yeah, there is a reference, and there's associated ideas with that reference. Frege's advancement here, at least his proposal, is that, no, those are both right, but you're misunderstanding what you're making ideas do what senses really do, and therein lies your confusion. Because ideas don't have the objectivity needed in order to make to communicate one thought to another, for the communication of thoughts, for speech. The following analogy will perhaps clarify these relationships. Somebody observes the moon through a telescope. I compare the moon itself to the meaning.
Rejoitum.
It is the object of the observation. We need it by the real image projected by the object glass in the interior of the telescope, and by the retinal image of the observer. The former I compare to the sense. The latter is like the idea or experience. The optical image in the telescope is indeed one-sided and dependent upon the standpoint of observation, but it is still objective inasmuch as it can be used by several observers. Again, just these analogies are just marvelous, aren't they? So your retinal image is the idea. And of course, my retinal image is not the same as your retinal image. The object of the moon is the same, of course. That's the Bedeutung. And what is analogous to the sense is the image on the glass, which is not the object, but it is objective, because we can all see that same thing. It's a very nice illustration. At any rate, it could be arranged for several to use it simultaneously, but each one would have his own retinal image. On account of the diverse shapes of the observer's eyes, even a geometrical congruence could hardly be achieved, and an actual coincidence would be out of the question. This analogy might be developed still further by assuming A's retinal image made visible to B, or A might also see his own retinal image in a mirror. In this way, we might perhaps show how an idea can itself be taken as an object, but as such, it is not for the observer what it directly is for the person having the idea. But to pursue this would take us too far afield. So if you could see your own image, that image would become the object, an object. But it's not the same thing as the retinal image itself. So you can make an idea an object, but that changes its status from the subjective experience of having that idea, or that, in this case, experience. We can now recognize three levels of difference between words, expressions, or whole sentences. The difference may concern at most the ideas or the sense, but not the meaning, or finally the meaning as well. Now, he slips in here, he's talking about proper names, but he generalizes to words, and same thing with expressions or whole sentences. So his theory is he's talking about proper names here, but it applies to words in general and sentences in general. The difference may concern at most the ideas, right? So we can have the same sense, the same reference, but a different idea. Or the same sense, but not the meaning. Or finally, the meaning as well. With respect to the first level, it is to be noted that on account of the uncertain connection of ideas with words, a difference may hold for one person, which another does not find. The difference between a translation and the original text should properly not overstep the first level. To the possible difference, here belongs also the coloring and shading which poetic eloquence seeks to give to the sense. Such coloring and shading are not objective and must be evoked by each hearer or reader according to the hints of the poet or the speaker. Right, and so if you know, the debates about translation, right, you know, should we have literal translations or dynamic equivalents? Well, in dynamic equivalents, if you're going to translate the Divine Comedy, you know, Dante may use some image that wouldn't conjure up anything. You know, take something that's an agrarian community. That wouldn't have really any meaning, or at least wouldn't have any associated ideas in those people in an industrial community. So the poet who wanted to contemporize Dante may take a, be very free and try to come up with parable or a metaphor that is more understandable to the modern mind, and yet conjures up the same idea, at least tries to get there, versus the literal translation, which just wants to bring out the exact word meaning of the original text into the as close as you can to the target language. So, Frege would say that the literal translation would be may conjure up different ideas in the people that read it. Can't conjure up, if there's a distance enough, much of any ideas, if any idea at all. But that's a matter of the coloring, of the shading. The shading in translation may be different. But we continue. He says, such color and shading are not objective and must be evoked by the hearer or reader according to the hints of the poet or the speaker. Without some affinity in human ideas, arts would certainly be impossible. But it can never be exactly determined how far the intentions of the poet are realized. So we have, and I think this may talk to your point. I mean, since we're human beings, we have to have, you know, in order to make art possible, there has to be some feelings, ideas that are similar throughout time. And yet, that doesn't mean we're guaranteed to understand exactly what the intentions of the poet were in any given case. So that's what he calls here the coloring. So the coloring is a mode or a type of an idea. It's the feelings that are evoked with the word or the sentence. In what follows, there will be no further discussion of ideas and experiences, right? So